And talk about that first. So how are people feeling about the pandemic, about course plan? Any thoughts from last class? Yeah, numbers keep going up on campus. Opinions remain the same. We'll try to soldier on. More and more, like, for your own safety, my safety, safety of the community, we'll probably need to push online if things continue the way they are. But if it's everyone's preference, we'll give it a shot. And just to be clear, you are welcome anytime to just not show up. I still expect you to be digitally here during lectures, watch them live so that you can ask questions. You're free to hop in. Zihan, I know you're on. You're free to jump in and ask questions at any point. For you, Slido, which I have not yet logged into. Let me do that real quick. But any day, you're free to make that decision regardless of any decisions we make broadly about the course. We push things fully online, and we'll do it that way. But if you feel unsafe through this entire semester, you're welcome to do that. But I do still want you to, even though I post the recordings, watch things live. Probably know, but it's just too easy if you start skipping a lecture and watching a recording to fall behind and lose track and get in a bad spot in the course. So stay up on every lecture, be here during this time, whether physically or on Zoom. It's your option at any point. You're free to not show up. I monitor attendance, yeah. Attendance is required.
But even like if we were to be online, we would still.
So, like I said, I know Zion's online right now. It was last class. I'll be keeping track of who's around and attendance is required one way or the other. I won't be doing anything like you're required to turn your camera on, even if we go online. I want to see you logging in. Other thoughts, questions?
So, if you post the slides to your website, right?
Right. We can quickly. Here's the website, just updated from last time. So for Wednesday's lecture, the blank slides, I have those for this lecture too. I'll post them nominally the night before. So if you want to just have the slides I'm going to be writing on to take notes along with, you can print those out beforehand. Then middle link is my annotations on the slides that I did during lecture. And this is the recording from Zoom. So these two will pop up after lecture in an hour usually. Take some time to convert them. And then this one will be up the night before, so you can print them out in the morning if you like. And we'll do that all semester, all lectures.
The homework being due next Friday, I was curious when you assigned them.
A week before, so I'll post
Okay.
it sometime after class.
Okay. I was just curious.
Yeah, I normally won't. You won't see them here until they're posted. It's for the first week, put that on there so you know it's going to pop up here. Here's where you can be checking. But from here on, they'll just pop up when they're assigned. Any other questions? Thoughts? You've been joking. Many of my colleagues did the same. Hey, can be in class, but if you don't feel comfortable, don't show up. A few of them had zero people show up the first lecture. Oh, my guy showed up. Great. They're excited about power electronics. Glad to hear that. Okay, so let's hop in what we were talking about last time. We were just using this motivating example of a 12 volt to 48 volt converter or something, kind of with the voltage ratings on a mild hybrid electric vehicle, but really just looking at some design. We took let TI do the hard work for us and then took their design for what this boost converter should look like and started looking at the operation. Found this, their design did okay, about 94% efficiency, looked pretty close to some ideal boost converter waveforms. The only problem thing that was a little bit different was this huge spike here. Happens when the MOSFET turns on. So zoomed in on that, looked at the behavior, found that, well, things aren't so ideal when we have real devices. We don't have these nice instantaneous, when we tell it to, the MOSFET just immediately turns off and turns on, and the diode does the opposite. Instead, we have some intervening interval where our switching is kind of in the middle. The diode's not really off, the MOSFET's not really on, they're both kind of somewhere in the middle, and it results in a significant amount of energy loss. And then that energy loss translates into power loss according to the switching frequency. This much energy, this 7 microjoules lost every time we go through the switching action. We do that 202,000 times per second. So we end up with an average power loss of 1.5 watts in this case. For half of all of the losses in the converter are just coming from this switching energy. Made some arguments about where that's coming from. Essentially what's happening is the diode is not turning off when we turn the MOSFET on. It has this built up stored charge. It takes a while before that diode can actually turn off and become reverse biased. During that time, we have both the FET and the diode on, creating a path shorting out the output voltage and developing very high current. Once we've removed all that stored charge, the diode can finally shut off and we can finish our switching interval. Then comment on, if you look at the switch node waveform, it's kind of got two different segments. From here to here, the diode is fully on. We still see it dropping a little bit. And what this really is just the incremental resistance of the diode and that very high current. So it's got something like 40 milliohms of resistance. Look back. 40 milliohms of series resistance on the diode. Put 400 amps through that, we get about 15 volts of drop on the diode. So it's still fully on, clamping the switch node voltage up to 50. Just this really high current is causing some drop on its equivalent series resistance. So we kind of concluded at the end, what's the mechanism causing all this, and diode reverse recovery. So brief review of diode reverse recovery. Where does it come from? It comes from both a nice and terrible characteristic of this diode here, which is that nominally our power diodes are PN diodes, which look like some PN junction and semiconductor with some ohmic metal contacts on either side. High voltage power diodes are more often PIN, meaning it's going to have a heavily doped P region, then a very lightly doped N region, and then a very heavily doped N plus region at the top. That just has to do with getting it to higher voltage. Mechanisms are still going to be the same as a PN diode, more or less. Okay. So what we know about PN diodes is they are minority carrier devices. Means that when it's on and conducting large current or biased diode, the majority of that current is supported by minority carriers in each region, holes in the N-type region, electrons, the P-type region. So as we turn it on and get it forward biased and up to our operating current, we have injection of holes from the P-type region into the N. And that'll be dominant stored charge as well as electrons coming back into the P region, some small depletion region in the middle. It's giving us a barrier voltage that eventually becomes the diode forward voltage. So we like that in one sense. Nice thing about minority carrier devices is we put more current through them, we get more minority carriers injected, which means the higher the current, the higher the conductance put a lot of current in it, it'll get very conductive. So that kind of fights conduction losses. Right? The more current you put, the more carriers you have, the resistance goes down. That's a great thing. Okay. The problem is to get this thing to turn off, we have to remove all those minority carriers. Okay? So this minority carrier injection is what makes the diode four bias, makes it conductive. To get it reverse biased, I have to pull all of those minority carriers back out so that it is no longer conductive and it's reverse biased in the off state. Okay. So the good thing about this is we have what's called conductivity modulation. Which is this effect where the more currents I put through it, the more carriers I get, the lower my resistance is. Bad thing about it, stored minority charge must be removed. Before I can turn it off. So some simplified waveforms over here on the left of the diode current ID, and then this voltage here, VD, during a time when a MOSFET turns on. Something like this boost converter, the diode is conducting a forward current IF, and then the MOSFET turns on. Ideally, the diode would just shut off, right? That'd be great. The MOSFET would instantaneously turn on, and we'd get square waves here. Fortunately, because of all that minority stored charge, that doesn't happen. What happens is, just assume the MOSFET is more or less ideal, has some small resistance to it, so it turns on. Suddenly, I've got both of these devices on. First thing that happens is, well, I can't start anything until the diode current gets below zero. As long as the diode current is up above zero, it's just going to stay forward biased, right? So we need the current from the inductor to divert from the diode down to the MOSFET first. Okay, that can happen pretty quickly. It's generally limited by whatever kind of impedance you're or the inductance you have in this loop. How quickly can I get current to drop here, increase here? Well, if there's any inductance, it's going to slow that down. Maybe you have a nanohenry of parasitics just from your layout and packaging. Okay. So this can't drop instantaneously in a real circuit, but it's going to drop pretty quickly down to the point where it hits zero. At this point here, I have zero current in the diode. If it weren't for this minority stored charge, it would shut off at that point and that'd be done. But the problem is, even once I hit zero current, I still have all these minority holes floating around in this N region. So it stays on. And the way I can get it to shut off is to pull those charges back out. To pull them back out, pulling holes this way is the same thing as saying I have negative current going through the diode. Right? So this current is going to continue to go negative. And all of this charge here is removing the stored minority charge. Okay, and once this charge QA is however much minority stored charge you have, finally you've removed it all and the diode's no longer conductive. And it can shut off. So at this point right here, the diode actually becomes reverse biased. Okay. What happens after that? Well, now it's got this peak negative current going through it. Its voltage is still zero. It's finally shut off, but it's got zero voltage across it. And I have a second set of charge I need to inject into this thing. This is no longer removing minority carriers. Instead, it's inserting majority carriers to establish the depletion region. It's charging the junction capacitance of this diode. Okay. So this is charging the depletion region of the diode. Really, the diode, anode to cathode capacitance. Okay, so what's the big problem with this? The big problem is loss. We look at these waveforms and say this may not actually look so bad. They've got all this extra current going on, but during that whole time, the diode voltage is zero. During this time, I have both voltage and current on the diodes. There's some non-zero power, but that's all just going into a capacitance, and I'm okay with storing energy in capacitances. It's just stored energy. So why is this such a problem? Problem because the diode's a bad friend. Okay. His issues hurt the MOSFET, his buddy. MOSFET's doing a great job. The diode's actually causing a bunch of loss in him. Reason is the MOSFET turns on here, and every bit of difference between IF, which should, what it was conducting before, should be the inductor current, which should be IL. And as that current is diverted away from the diode, where does it go? It goes through the MOSFET. And the MOSFET's voltage is V out minus the diode voltage by KVL here. So this whole time, it's got V out, drain to source voltage, plan up there. And it's got a bunch of current flowing through it. The difference between IL and this, that's all that's going through the MOSFET. So it goes up to IL. And then overshoots it, goes even higher than the inductor current. So it's the diode's problem, but most of the losses show up down on the MOSFET because it's clamping the voltage. All this current going through the MOSFET is going through 50 volts and has very large loss on it. Okay. Simple approximation for reverse recovery power loss is it's going to be, again, periodic. So it'll be FS times however much energy I lose here in this process. The energy is dominantly what's lost on the MOSFET. And approximation we'll generally make, say, this happens very quickly. This DI DT interval, relatively short, I'll ignore it. So the loss on the MOSFET is going to be the inductor current flowing through the full output voltage for this whole interval, plus all of this charge, every bit that causes the current to go above IL, times the output voltage. The charge is also pulled through the output voltage. So kind of approximate it as VIL TRR plus VQRR times FS. Okay, where V is whatever voltage is across the series combination of these two elements. Boost converter, that's the output voltage. If it was a buck converter, it'd be the input voltage. Everything else would be somewhere else. Okay. So what is that? VILTRR. Some squinty looks. Kind of accounting for this time here. During this, I mean, this is pretty small. This whole interval is TRR width. The MOSFET has IL current going through it, plus this stuff that'll be accounted for in a different term, and V voltage across it. So when this interval is relatively small, this interval is relatively small. Then we account for this charge with this term, and then this is just the effect of all of this stuff. Okay. It's a rough approximation. Not a great one. The problem is, even if we spend the time and account a little bit more accurately for these waveforms, very hard to predict this reverse recovery loss accurately. Okay, so we need to know very well what the parasitic inductance of this power loop is, the kind of model of the behavior here. And then even these parameters, reverse recovery time, or reverse recovery charge. So I haven't defined that on this plot. those things are highly nonlinear, depend on just about everything going on in this transition. So this is just from the data sheet of some power diode plots for the reverse recovery charge and reverse recovery time. And see, they vary with things like temperature, things like how much current was being conducted prior to the diode starting to shut off. What is the ramp rate of the forward current of the diode? They vary in nonlinear and kind of hard to model ways. Both QRR and TRR are some functions of things like temperature, things like IL in a nominal converter, this DIFDT, the function of the reverse voltage, other things. They're not constants, they're hard to predict analytically, and almost always you don't have what you want on the data sheet. Example of the diode we're using in our converter got a forward current of 3 amps when it shuts off. So having curves for 15 and 30 amps is not necessarily going to give me a good idea of what it should be at 4 amps or 3 amps.
The FDT is dominated by the power circuit impedance.
Yeah. Any other impedance in that loop? Can also be slowed by the gate drive waveform on the MOSFET. How quickly does the MOSFET actually turn on? Right. So this all assumes that at this time, the MOSFET is just on. Goes from being an open to being some very small resistance. Okay. If the MOSFET takes 10 nanoseconds where it's kind of in saturation and not really fully turned on, that can slow that transition. So, diode reverse recovery loss. Similar things come up when we start looking at other minority carrier devices. So here I'm just showing cross sections of a power MOSFET and a power IGBT. IGBT is a minority carrier device, like the PN diode. MOSFET is a majority carrier device. Okay. The cross sections of just a unit cell of a large power device, power MOSFETs, power IGBTs, at least traditional silicon ones, are vertical devices. The drain and source are on opposite sides. So MOSFET, for example, drain to source current would come in the drain, go through this large N minus drift region, the gates on, form a small channel here, conduct through the channel, and then go out the source. This is my idea. If I wanted to build this up into a power device, I'd have many hundreds, thousands more of these unit cells all in parallel on a small chip. To get the MOSFET that you buy, a discrete MOSFET. And built up of these micrometer by a couple micrometer unit cells, parallel up a bunch more of them if I want the resistance to go down, if I want it to block higher voltage, make the device physically taller so that I have a bigger drift region here to block more voltage on. Okay. So, IGBT, almost the exact same thing. The difference is this P region down here instead of N on a MOSFET. Means is I've got minority carrier injection just like we had in the diode. I'm going to be, when I'm conducting, collector to emitter current, ICE. I'm injecting these minority carrier holes and the current here is sustained by those minority carriers. So that gives me kind of the same trade-offs as we just talked about with the diode. Great thing. Conductivity modulation. bad thing, stored charge. Okay. MOSFET, on the other hand, is a majority carrier device. That means that I'm not going to have these minority carriers being injected. Instead, the current is supported by electrons in this large N minus region. Okay. So, really good thing is no stored minority carrier charge. The trade-off for the thing I take a hit on to get that is that I need to design the height and doping density of this drift region to get the resistance I want, and that's the resistance it's going to be. Right. So my minimum R on is limited by doping. So in a high voltage device, kind of everywhere along this IDS conduction path, everything has resistance. Resistance to get through the metal, get up through the strip region, under the gate, through the channel, through the source contacts, out through the top metal. If it's a high voltage device, hundreds of volts or more, this piece dominates. Resistance right here through the drift region is basically the resistance of the device. And I run into limitations on what I can do with that. Because there is no minority carrier injection, if I want R on to be smaller, I either make this region shorter or dope with higher density, with more doped electron charges in there. Both of those things reduce my blocking voltage of the device. So there's a trade-off there. If I want it to block high voltage, I have to make this so tall and dope it less densely. That gives me a higher resistance, and I'm kind of constrained to that trade-off. An IGBT, say, build it to block the voltage and then just make it inject a bunch of minority carriers when it's conducting, so that my resistance isn't limited by that effect. As we go to look at high frequency design, fast switching converters, and really optimization means most applications we're going to be biased over here. Okay? Even though this can conduct well at very high currents, this minority carrier injection is going to cause similar things to reverse recovery loss, current tailing in IGBTs, but it's going to cause a lot of switching loss that really hurts us. MOSFETs, on the other hand, can switch pretty fast with pretty low loss. But we're going to have a little more constraints if we try to go to very high voltage or power. Power generally, say, if I look at the conduction models at the first order of each of these, a MOSFET just looks like some on resistance. IGBT predominantly is going to look like some VCE drop, VCE sat. Comes from this PN junction that we're conducting through. Does have some incremental resistance, but that's going to be relatively small at high currents due to this minority carrier injection. So if I look at the conduction loss of these two devices, assume they're similar devices, and I'm plotting versus IDS or ICE, depending on which device it is. My conduction loss in a MOSFET looks like I squared R. So as I put more current through it, I'm going to get an I squared R on type relationship. Conduction losses in IGBT look dominantly like ICE times VCE. So that's going to be this type of relationship. Draw that flat. What does it mean as I go to higher and higher currents, and IGBT is always going to win out? Depending on your application, that may be a couple thousand amps and at a point you don't care about. MOSFETs are always better. But when you go up to real high power stuff, an IGBT will win, because at some point, I times something is always smaller than I squared times something. Okay? Depending on VCE and R on, that point will move. But going I to the first power is always going to be better in the long run. Questions on this stuff?
Sure.
So current tailing is really analogous to this reverse recovery charge. It's the same idea. When I want to shut this IGBT off, I have, because I was conducting current through it, a bunch of stored minority carrier charges in it. To get those out, I have to have either two ways to get either here or here, get this minority carrier charge out. First, they are minority carriers. Okay? So if you just let the device sit, they'll recombine with the majority carriers and kind of dissipate themselves. Right? They do so relatively slowly. Okay? The other option is to forcibly pull them out using some field, which is what we're doing in this reverse recovery case. Okay? They would passively recombine and just go away over some many microseconds or more. Okay? There's a minority carrier lifetime. It has a constant tau, says how quickly they recombine and will just disappear. If you can design a converter so that you can have your diode conduct and then just be ripped out of the circuit and sit over here for a millisecond and then go back in, well, you wouldn't have this reverse recovery charge. They kind of passively recombine on their own. The problem is when the MOSFET turns on, it forces them to very quickly be removed and shut off because of this loss. Okay. IGBT current tailing, depending on what the rest of your circuit is a little bit more like passive recombination. But as I begin to shut it off, since I'm not turning on another device and forcibly ripping them out, we kind of have to just slowly wait as those minority carriers recombine and the device actually shuts off. That's why you see in these waveforms in a typical buck converter here, as we go to shut off the IGBT, the current tailing effect, the current in the IGBT itself ends the drop, but then it has this long tail where it's those minority carriers are passively recombining and slowly getting the device to go fully turned off. Causes a long tail on the switching energy during the switching transition. That is unavoidable in this type of converter with a minority carrier device. You can put something in there to remove them more quickly. Base thing would be to replace this diode with FET and turn it on harder right at the beginning so that it can rip those charges out, but you're still going to end up with the loss associated with them. It'll look more like reverse recovery. You can find ways. There are auxiliary circuits, and we'll talk about some of them in this course, not really for IGBT so much. We'll focus mostly on MOSFETs, but the same circuits can be used to remove these charges with less loss. The idea is back to this. Okay, when I was removing those stored minority charges, didn't hurt the diode, right? It hurt the MOSFET. The MOSFET turning on is what forced a large voltage that ripped all those minority carrier charges out. So if I could put some auxiliary circuit here, say some small current source with a switch in parallel with this diode that when I wanted it to turn off, just push a bunch of current through it to remove all those charges, then let the MOSFET turn on, that current source would only see VF across it and be relatively low loss. So there are ways to do it with a different circuit to pull that current out, but just natively doing it by forcing V across that diode or across the MOSFET while you pull those charges out is going to be high loss. Make sense? Yeah. So, same thing generally, conclusion is minority carrier devices are going to be a large problem if we're trying to push up to higher switching frequencies keeping the switching losses down. Okay.
When we say write a band against the events, we are like GAN or target, we are referring to most events, right?
Not necessarily, but almost always. So there are, you can make a minority carrier device out of any of these materials. There are some BJT silicon carbide devices. So the material and the device structure are separate, right? What you can buy right now in GaN or silicon carbide are largely majority carrier devices. Silicon carbide is all majority carrier. GaN is this hemp thing. It's kind of its own deal, a little bit different than either of these. But in theory, could create an IGBT out of either material. And there is active research and significant interest in that. Right, silicon carbide is allowing us to get to higher voltages while still using a MOSFET. And it's their material characteristics that allow us to push a little bit further on the trade-off I talked about here. You want higher voltage, you're going to get higher resistance. Because to block that voltage without this device breaking down, you need to either dope more lightly or make this region taller, either which increases the resistance. Okay. Silicon carbide, because of the carrier mobility and the critical electron field, can go a little bit further on that trade-off. Okay. Just material characteristics allow you to say, okay, I can get to a little bit higher voltage with still having a reasonable resistance. And since these are unit cells, anything that talks about that, you'll talk about resistance per square area. So I can get to whatever resistance you want. Just parallel a billion of these, get the resistance down. Problem with that is it's a huge thing, super expensive, and it has a lot of capacitance, a lot of additional charges because it's such a big area. Okay. But with a silicon carbide MOSFET, you're still constrained by that. You have different material parameters that allow you to go further, but it's still fundamentally the resistance and breakdown voltage trade off of one another. You do a silicon carbide BJT or IGBT, you may be able to go up to a higher voltage device and still have it be reasonable in terms of conduction loss. You know, 10, 30 kilovolt silicon carbide devices. Perhaps we could do a 100 kilovolt silicon carbide BJT. Don't know that. But very high voltages and high powers still shows advantage. Another question? Oops. I'm trying to keep checking Slido. My phone goes to sleep, just so you don't think I'm texting or anything on the phone here. In case anybody online has questions, or anybody here. Okay, so the first time I taught this course, I spent a couple weeks talking about device optimization, about where these per square area capacitances and resistance comes from, what are the physical equations behind them. I've since cut that out of the course. If you're interested, let me know, and I can refer you to videos and lecture slides from that. But I've kind of remove that as saying it's not so well within the scope of this course. So I just speak briefly about it here. Some motivation of, okay, lower powers, faster switching things, things that are meant to be super high efficiency in the sub 10 kilovolt range, we're largely going to be talking about MOSFETs. You're looking at 50 kilovolts in a megawatt, IGBTs definitely come into play. The wide band gap is eating some of their lunch at the moment. Okay, so going back to our example, where were we? Well, this PN diode and its reverse recovery was killing us half of our total loss. That loss came from it being a minority carrier device. So what can we do about that? We can replace it with the majority carrier device. It is a MOSFET, not really, but there's also this thing called a Schottky diode. Haven't seen it before. It behaves like a diode, but has conduction characteristics like a MOSFET. Okay. Traditional PN diode we sketched before, the Schottky diode, will have only one type of semiconductor. There will be a metal semiconductor, let's just draw metal, like an N-type semiconductor and then two different metals attached on either end. This side, it would be kind of the same thing we call an ohmic contact. Same thing with any of these semiconductors we looked at before. It's just going from semiconductor to metal, and it should just look like a very small resistance, just getting the conduction out to metal. This other side, though, is what we call a Schottky contact. Schottky contact. It's developed by looking at electron work functions between this metal and the semiconductor and selecting a different metal and a different doping density until you can actually get a built-in diode junction there. So I have a traditional contact here. This more often than not will be some kind of exotic metal in order to get the conduction characteristics through there to be a barrier voltage, have an actual diode-like characteristic between the metal and the semiconductor. You'll also relatively commonly find different doping densities close to that junction than through the rest of the channel. Okay. So that ends up giving you diode-like behavior, but there's no p-type material. There are no minority carriers at all anywhere. So it's going to conduct more like a MOSFET. Again, you're going to lose that conductivity modulation, but you have no stored charge. The barrier voltage will have to do with the two materials, and then the resistance of this device will be higher than a traditional diode and just determined by your doping density through the semiconductors. Okay. These Schottky diodes work great for certain applications, but like we were talking about back here, they're going to be very limited in voltage above about 200 volts. You can't find many silicon Schottky diodes. There's another, the big silicon carbide, big entry onto the market years ago was creating silicon carbide Schottky diodes at 600 volts and above, 1200 volts, high voltages. Because of this limitation, not having minority storage charges, silicon Schottky diodes above a couple hundred volts are just way too high resistance. Silicon carbide, because of the material characteristics, is constrained by those same trade-offs, but can push a little further. So Schottky diodes, great thing, no reverse recovery charge. Picked some silicon Schottky diode and threw it in the circuit in place of our old PN diode. I'll change this device here. And what do I see? Is I gain back about 2% increase in efficiency. All right, easy enough. But I thought I was going to get 3. Back to our old calculations, said, okay, looking at the waveforms here, this stuff that was happening at the switching transition was causing about 3% of our power to be lost. So it comes from diode reverse recovery, looking at the waveforms, talked about minority and majority carrier stored charge, replaced it with a Schottky. I got 2% back, but still have that 1%. Where did that go? Okay. So, well, let's go and simulate this thing, see what we have. Here's my simulated waveforms. Things, again, look pretty close to the ideal case, but this darn spike is still here. See, it's gotten way smaller in magnitude. Before it was off the screen and we looked at it and the currents went to plus and minus 400 amps. Now, at least this negative current is only going down to about minus 6 amps or so. Positive is still a little bit off the screen. So we've definitely done something to improve this, but still having trouble at the transition when the MOSFETs turn on. Let's again zoom in on that. What we see is that the waveforms and dynamics of this transition have changed significantly now that we got rid of that reverse recovery charge. No longer looks like switch node voltage clamped until this current through the diode goes to some huge negative value instead. Now kind of the currents and the switch node voltage are changing at the same time, but not instantaneous stair steps. And we don't have zero time where we have both voltage and current on the devices. Still end up with some loss coming out of it. So we're a little closer now. My diode current still goes a little bit negative. Nothing like the minus 400 amps. My MOSFET current still goes up and overshoots its final value. Should be going from about 3 amps to 0 on the diode, 0 to 3 amps on the MOSFET. But much more constrained. Overall doesn't look too terrible. So come down here and look at the instantaneous power loss through each of these devices. Let me integrate those up and say, what's the area under here? With an energy of about 250 nanojoules in this case. So for a power of about 50 milliwatts. Of 0.1% of my output power. If I go back, saying that hey, I thought I would get 3%, I only got 2%, I got 1% extra losses here. Even going in and looking at this, it's only about 0.1%, almost nothing. So where is the rest of it? Well, this was the thing that obviously looked bad about the waveform, but let me just for fun go and look at what happens during the other switching transition. Okay, so here I'm looking at this switching transition, the turn off of the FET. If I go look at that, diode current, MOSFET current, switch node voltage, gate voltage, and then instantaneous powers on each of these devices. Look at what is the energy dissipation here in the MOSFET during this transition. There's no spike, nothing that looks obviously terrible. I've got a much bigger energy here. 1.3 microjoules. That ends up giving a power. E off FS is about 260 milliwatts. About 0.5% of my output power. Now suddenly more of that energy is showing up in the waveforms here during the turn off of the MOSFET. Even though there's no spike, I've got a bunch of energy here on the MOSFET, instantaneous power on the MOSFET. Okay. Happening there. We've got some non-ideal transition here. This point is where I tell the MOSFET to turn off. Got a little bit of delay before the switch node voltage begins to rise. It begins to rise during most of this transition. My currents aren't changing at all. So while still having the majority of the current through the transistor, its drain to source voltage is rising. Taking the product of these two, I get some energy through it. Okay, well, so it wasn't just reverse recovery. We got more to look at in these switching intervals. So we need to actually look at how does the MOSFET switch. Do so looking at the static curves and the dynamic behaviors, stored charges in the MOSFET. See what kind of behaviors are going on here. We'll go through them relatively briefly here and then in more detail through the next few weeks of the course. Okay. We're out of time for today. So that's where we will pick up on Monday. For Monday, I will email out if there's any change in plan on in-class versus online. But regardless, you always have the option to stay home and watch online if you elect to do so. Because you feel it is unsafe or because you feel more comfortable doing that. your option. Okay. Thanks, everyone.